Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, historian and biographer Paul Hendrickson discusses writing about his own family's history and his recent book, Fighting the Night, Iwo Jima, World War II, and a Flyer's Life. Paul is joined by book critic Elizabeth Taylor. The following conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our next program here on the History and Biography stage at the American Writers Festival. History and biography aren't always about strangers. Sometimes the most complex subject for a writer is their own family's history or a well-known story they suddenly see with new eyes. In Fighting the Night, award-winning writer Paul Hendrickson explores the fierce Black Widow fighters on Iwo Jima during World War II and interrogates his father's war stories along with historical accounts. Paul is a National Book Critics Circle Award winner, a National Book Award finalist, and a New York Times bestselling author for Hemingway's Boat. He'll be interviewed today by Chicago Tribune Literary Editor-at-Large Elizabeth Taylor. Welcome to you both.
It's wonderful to be here, and I'm just so honored. And this book has been simmering in Paul. He writes that it's been simmering in his head for a long time, and I know how long it's been simmering, because it was the election of, you remind me, George
H.W. Bush, 1980.
It's simmering because I was a reporter for Time, he was a reporter for the Washington Post, we were on the campaign plane covering actually the losers' candidates. And so they gave us a little prop plane and in Iowa and told us to get on. And I was petrified, white-knuckled. And before we could get on, Paul steered me to the right seat and said, this is where my dad said to sit. This is where my father said to sit on a plane. So that has been with me. So I always go for those perfect seats on the plane.
I'm so happy Elizabeth started with that story. It was the frozen January tundra of 1980. And there we were both in Iowa on these, waiting to board this little 8 or 10 seater campaign plane. She's probably a nervous flyer in any circumstance. She was eyeing this plane very dubiously. I was there for the Washington Post. She was there for Time Magazine. This is 1980, George H.W. Bush.
I think it was later. Don't make me seem so old.
Was it later? I want it to be 44 years ago. I don't know when it was. But I remember I was about to go off on leave to write my first book. Anyway, we didn't know each other. We were both standing there waiting for the door of this little light cedar plane to open. And she just seemed so nervous to board. And so I kind of uncharacteristically, she was a reporter, I was a reporter. I took her arm, I said, follow me. And I said, my dad says the safest place is sitting toward the back. And that's where we sat, and here we are today, all these years later.
Survived those. So actually, and Paul, we met then, and I remember something else. So I'm like, oh, you're Paul Hendrickson. And the remarkable thing was, like, he had written a memoir.
O Seminary,
which I had read. And I said, oh my gosh, you're Paul Hendrickson. So here we are, full circle, a memoir, your time in the seminary. And now, years later, your time as an
That's a beautiful question, Elizabeth, and I'll try to say something about that. But before I do, and I'm famous for taking these detours and tangents in my writing, and I get criticized for it, will you allow me, as an audience, to do the quickest detour? We can't allow this to descend into a mutual admiration society, but Elizabeth, whom I long ago began calling E.T., because her friends call her that, Elizabeth Taylor, E.T., she's been such a literary stalwart for the city of Chicago for so many decades. After Time magazine, she wound her way to the Chicago Tribune, where at one point she was editor of the Chicago Tribune Sunday magazine, as well as the book world editor. And she has been she's been president of the National Book Critics Circle Award. We have kind of been apart and been together all these decades as we've pursued our different things. So, Elizabeth, you said a minute ago it was your honor to be up on stage. It's my honor to sit here next to you, because, and I'm preaching to the choir. There have to be people in this audience who know Elizabeth Taylor's renown. I just want to quickly shout out to my wife, Seal, who's accompanying me on this trip. We came from Philadelphia, and Seal is another kind of stalwart, and I couldn't do any of this without the support of Seal. And one other thing, my kid brother is in the audience today, Mark Hendrickson, the only one of our dad's children, five children, four sons and a boy, the only one who became an aviator, who followed my father into his profession. And Mark is here, and I'm with his partner, Nancy, and I am so honored that they're here. They came from the western suburbs to be part of this. But yes, this is a book about, so already too common, you know, this is a book about flying. Well, Elizabeth and I met over flying. Right. We met over aviation, and I'm so proud that my kid brother is here, who has upheld the family tradition of flying, because none of the rest of the kids could fly a lick, but Mark is the flyer in the family.
Well, you're flying high in different ways. This biography simmered for a long time, but I'm going to go on a tangent, because is Mark the one that found the documents?
Mark did. So why are we talking about Mark here? It's supposed to be about me. Yes, I'm the reporter researcher. Mark found on the internet an hour-long oral history that our dad made of his flying career and of his career flying night fighters on Iwo Jima. Mark found it on the internet that our dad did with the Wisconsin Historical Society 10 months before he died. It never occurred to my pea brain that my father might have done something like that. And I researched obsessively in this book, and Mark called me up one day and he said, I found on the internet this hour-long interview. That was like lost treasure of the Incas. Hey, I didn't answer a minute ago what Elizabeth started out by saying. Yes, we met when I was just preparing to go off on leave to write a reported memoir of my Catholic seminary days studying for the priesthood back in the 1950s. And what Elizabeth was getting at was that here is the loop around all these years later, you might say the book ending, if that was a reported memoir, this is a reported memoir. Is the implicit thing you're saying is that I'm all washed up, there's nothing left, there's no more books to be written? Is that what you're trying to say?
No. Listen, you've had you've been a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle three times, won once. I mean, you had this magical career, but I will say that on this flight, you talked about being blocked. And reading this book, it's hard to imagine you being blocked. Can you, it seems so easy to write a book. I mean, when you're here and it looks beautiful, but you've had hard times. You've been blocked. Not in this book, but.
Elizabeth asks such beautiful questions. Yeah, I have been blocked a lot as a writer. The books get out, they get done, but the degree of fear and doubt that haunts you every day until the book gets done. And Elizabeth knows this history. I was working on a big book about Vietnam, about the architect of our disaster in Vietnam, the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara. I gave that book up. I crawled back to my reporting job at the Washington Post. I felt total failure. And my wife, whom I just shouted out, was there to prop me up and support me, but could do nothing to help me write the book that was failing every day on the ground floor of our rented townhouse on Capitol Hill in Washington. That book eventually got done 12 years after it started, with another book in between. You know, writers get blocked. And I would think that if there's any subject that would be made for blockage, it would be this. The whole dilemma of fathers and sons, that's tailor-made. That's ready-made to get emotionally, psychologically blocked. I think Elizabeth referenced this at the start. This book has been simmering on the back of my eyeball for 50 years. And when I actually got down to the doing of it, sure, there were just these terrible night sweats. But it came faster than I thought it might. It really did surprise me that I got it done. I published the previous book in 2019 about Frank Lloyd Wright, and here it's 2024, that's 5 years later. For me, that's an overland speed record. But I got it done somehow.
You did. So, as I recall, one of the books that was sort of in the middle there was involved photography. And one of the things that's wonderful about all of your work is that it feels like you see the world as a picture, and you see, train your eye to see in the frame. Can you talk about the photography and then the photographs that precede, like the chapters in this book, are extraordinary?
For the last 26 years, I have taught at the University of Pennsylvania writing workshops. I have finished my teaching days now at Penn just as of this semester, but because I'm an old dude and I need to let younger and better people do it. But I inaugurated a course called The Hungry Eye, Telling Stories Out of Photographs. We get the students to literally try and figuratively try to walk back in, almost step back in to a photograph of their family history, maybe, but an iconic photograph in our cultural history. But Elizabeth's question, she said, why do you see the world? How do you see the world visually? I can't answer that, Elizabeth, except that I do. I seem, to whatever minor degree of storytelling power that I might have on a given day, if it exists within the borders of a rectangle, if I can. So a lot of this book, I'm re-entering these wonderful, old, moody 1940s photographs and earlier photographs of my father on his Kentucky sharecropping farm in the 1930s, or standing on the tarmac in Iwo Jima. If I can have the fleshy feel of that and really dream my way into it, I can begin to find a writing power. I came up with an equation, not an Einstein equation, that I gave to my writing students, and I put it on the board, and here it is. F plus M plus I equals M. What does that stand for? It stands for fact. All the fact that you can find out about this photograph, plus memory, our collective memory, our psychic memory, but our actual memory. Fact plus memory plus I. What would the I stand for? Imagination. Fact plus memory plus imagination. F plus M plus I equals will render you the big M. Meaning. Fact plus memory plus imagination equals meaning.
Or masterpiece. And this is a masterpiece, really. So the picture on the front, the photograph on the front. Tell us about Rita B.
This is my dad in his cockpit, taken during the day, but he flew always at night. That's one of the powerful things in my imagination. This was a very high-tech airplane that came in very late in the war. The first operational aircraft of World War II, designed specifically as a night fighter. But these guys in 1945 are flying around in the pitch of the Pacific dark What a powerful idea that is. No matter what technical, highly sophisticated machinery was sealed in the nose of this aircraft, this radar detection equipment, they are still doing something pretty amazing. These are pitch black conditions over an ocean, and you're navigating your way to that. Elizabeth is wondering, we were standing outside a while ago and two people said, boy, you look just like the guy. You look just like your father in that photograph. I have to take that on faith. I can't quite see that as much, perhaps, as some other people see it. But this is my dad in the cockpit of the Rita B. And the Rita B was painted in curvy white on the glossy black nose of this airplane. The Rita B was my mom, Rita Bernadine. And in Hawaii, when they got their planes, before they went on to the war zones, he grabbed somebody and he said, I want you to paint my wife's name on my plane and make it damn beautiful. Yes, sir, Lieutenant. So the Rita B got painted on the nose. But that's my dad. He's 25. I can't begin to tell you what I was doing at 25, but I would not have the bravery to do something like this at 25. You see, these guys, it's my theory anyway, were participating in something they knew was way, way beyond them. They had a sense they were participating in a moment of history, and they were scared every day of their lives. But they did it, and they walked out to their equipment at night to go up for 2 hours or 2.5 hours. Often they were simply patrol missions around Iwo Jima, but at other times they were intruder missions, which were not defensive but offensive, going to neighboring Japanese-held islands and bombing and strafing. My dad was 25 when he did this, and my mom, waiting out the war, like how many 10 million other war wives, was waiting at the home of her parents in Xenia, Ohio, which is this little farm town, and she had two babies on her hip, one of whom was me, 5 months old, and the other was my older brother, Marty, who was... He's 16 months older than I am, so he was 21 months old when my parents said goodbye. My parents said goodbye to each other at a scabby motel lodge in Amarillo, Texas, one morning in September of 1944. No idea that they would ever see each other again in this world. And my mother told me once that she wrote to my father every day he was overseas. And he wrote back to her maybe 2 or 3 times. We have none of those letters. My kid brother and I and my sister in Ohio, we share among us mementos, these photographs. These photographs are treasures. They're filtered through and they're strewn throughout the book. But we have none of those letters disappeared. That's only one of the things I'm haunted by. Only one of the things that breaks my heart, only one of the things I have such deep regret about, where are the letters? They're gone.
But you imagined them. You put your imagination into it.
I did imagine
and
them.
And you did, and it's astonishing. You also connected with his friends,
yes.
People, his contemporaries, who were with him. And I think it gives this book so much power.
Every question Elizabeth asks me opens up a trap door to a whole vault of other. Yes, this is a book about my father's experience overseas. It's, you know what? World War II is like the stage set. It's really a story about fathers and sons. I mean, a few critics have complained already, or the people, the trolls on Amazon or whomever. They say, where's the war? There's plenty of war in this book. There's plenty of war. But in another way, it's a story about fathers and sons. But Elizabeth just said, I was able to find someone in East Sacramento, California, who was still alive, who piloted this plane with my dad in my dad's squadron. He was the last living airman of the 549th Night Fighter Squadron, which was my dad's squadron. There were only 300 people in the squadron, and only 50 of them were pilots. The others were enlisted men or radar operators or navigators, gunners. Some of them were officers, most of them enlisted men. But I found the last living pilot, 97 years old. You would think if you found someone 97 years old, well, first of all, what are the actuarial chances? Slim to none, right? That when you start out to research this book after having it hang on your eyeball for half a decade, slim to none, you'll find someone. Ray Rudkin picked up the phone and he said, yeah, that's me. I'm Ray Rudkin. Yeah, I flew her. Yeah, I'm sitting out here in the garage trimming my fingernails. And I said, Mr. Rudkin, this was the pitch of the pandemic, and my doctor wouldn't let me go out there for another 9 months. I called him every month, and we talked and we talked and we talked, and just begging, saying my wayward seminary boy prayers that he would still be alive. And he was when I went out there. The first time I talked to him, he said, yeah, I'm sitting out here in the garage. It's a beautiful day in California. I'm trimming my fingernails. And he said, hey, about a foot and a half from where I'm talking to you is an old locker, foot locker, full of photographs and mementos from the war and from Iwo Jima. Maybe you'd be interested in seeing them. Yes, I would.
You know that Michael, you refer to Michael Herr in the book, in that extraordinary book, Dispatches, and this, is it possible they were there and not haunted?
Michael Herr wrote the great book about Vietnam, not World War II.
Oh,
and
right.
I know some of you know it. It's called Dispatches.
Right.
I think it's the book about Vietnam. And Elizabeth is such an astute, I mean, Elizabeth picks out the things.
Yeah.
Michael Herr's line in Dispatches is it possible they were there and not haunted? No, not possible. So I think my father was there, and he was haunted. And I regret that I did not get to talk to him more about the war. Those guys didn't talk about it. They didn't want to talk, or when they did, they talked about it elliptically. The lens of the camera would open like that, and then it would shut again. I got him to talk about it 5 or 6 times. That's why when Mark found an hour-long oral history, so to this day, I don't think Mark knows, I don't know why and how are the circumstances that my dad even gave that oral history. He was 10 months from his dying, and I think he wanted to open up to a way that maybe he couldn't to his own writing son. He wanted to get something down for history's sake, but if Michael Herr's line is about, is it possible they were there and not haunted? My line is, I am haunted. I am consumed with regret with all I don't know about my father in the war.
But in a way, I'm thinking that your memoir is really finding the light.
Oh boy,
not the night. You found the light.
I got a piece of the light. A while ago when I was talking about being blocked and I took 12 years to write a book about Vietnam called The Living and the Dead, and another book was written in between, and I went back to the Washington Post, not knowing if I could even write a short little story for the Washington Post. My confidence was shattered. That book that was in between was about a great documentary photographer
right.
of the 1930s, Marion Post Wolcott. Elizabeth knows that book.
Right.
Elizabeth was the literary editor, the editor of the book section of the Chicago Tribune, and commissioned a review to an outside reviewer, and that reviewer reviewed that book so beautifully. That book is about looking for the light. That book is entitled Looking for the Light. Elizabeth, the only way I would respond is that all of these books are sort of looking for the light. They're searches.
It's extraordinary to read your work because it's exactly how you speak. I don't know how you translate your speech to the page.
I read poetry late at night.
It's the cadence is extraordinary.
I told a joke the other night at a book event that my wife rolls her eyes before I turn out the lights. She said, "Oh no, you're reading another moody poet." But I read a lot. I can't write poetry, but I do read the poetry.
But I mean, the book is poetry, and it has the sensibility of a poet because you can turn facts into something lyrical, which reminds me. The Sharon Olds quote. Do you want the poem that... And Paul doesn't just smash these poems into other contexts. They fit perfectly.
She's referencing the great poet Sharon Olds wrote a long poem. The poem is about her deep love for her mother and father, but in another way, knowing that really... they should have chosen other people. My parents had a 61-year marriage, and I cannot stand here and sit here in front of you and say that it was blissful. My brother Mark would never allow me to say that. They had great loyalty to each other and great tenderness to each other. They were Catholic. There was no question that they could divorce or separate, but ideally they were not matched people, and yet they stayed together. They produced 5 children. This poem, you'd have to read the entire poem by Sharon Olds, but just these 4 lines, and this is the only thing out in the hallway that Elizabeth wondered if I would read, and I didn't say no, I won't, because I put them in the book, and the poem, the lines are so meaningful to me, and so perhaps they'll be meaningful to you. The title of the poem is "I Go Back to May 1937, and Sharon Olds is thinking about how her parents met at the college gate. Well, my parents didn't meet at the college gate. My parents were high school graduates, and World War II came along. I want to go up to them and say, "Stop! Don't do it! She's the wrong woman. He's the wrong man. You are going to do things you cannot imagine you would ever do." So, Elizabeth, I do want to say this, though, and I'm not trying to put the patina of spin and good feeling on it. No. No. In for a dime, in for a dollar. Let the truth rinse and wash. You know, Robert McNamara, I was talking about the Vietnam book, his son, what would it be like to be the son of the Secretary of Defense who got us into the Vietnam War? Craig McNamara, he and I are good friends, he said to me once, "Paul, let it all rinse and wash." In some sense, this book is about trying to let it all rinse and wash. But I want to say this and underline it. If I'm underlining the Sharon Olds poem, I want to underline it with this. My parents, I mean, I was saying this a minute ago. My mother's 21 with 2 babies. My father's 25. They say goodbye to each other. They don't know if they'll ever see each other again. That part of their lives, I feel, is absolutely good, even heroic. If the reader comes away from this book and not feeling that it's not a tribute, even though the sorrows have to be there in the minor key, absolutely. The sorrows of their subsequent life, and my father, I think, suffering PTSD for 10 years. Who had a name for it? Nobody had that name. That has to be there if you're going to tell the story. But what they did, I feel, together as a young couple, that represents the best years of their lives. If I had been born in that period and had been 25 and was called to this little speck of volcanic sand in the Western Pacific called Iwo Jima, I don't think I would have been up to it. I don't think I could have done that, what my father did. So that's the context that I would say of the Sharon Olds.
So many wonderful poets you read that are in this. Robert Penn Warren, James Dickey. But your mother, she was the heart, the anchor. But you know, the women suffered during this period.
Yeah. Oh, Elizabeth, I'm so glad to talk about the women. You know, this book represents four generations.
Right.
My father, me, my two sons, and my two grandsons, to whom the book is dedicated. Their names are Jackson and Teddy. Teddy had a moon bounce party in Washington, D.C. today. He's 4 years old. We share the same birthday, April 29th. This book is dedicated to my grandsons, Jackson and Teddy. It is a male book, but Elizabeth just talked about the women. What my mother had to shoulder, which all the other war wives had to shoulder, what would it have been like getting on her knees every night praying that she would not become a war widow at age 21 with two babies? There would be an entire other book to be written about what the Rita B, her name, Rita Bernadine, waited out in her. If my father, every time he walked out to his plane with his RO, his radar operator, and his gunner, if he was a scared human being to go up there in the black, I think my mother, back in Xenia, Ohio, was terrified in her own way. And a whole other book stands to be written about that, but I won't be here to write it. I'm not gonna, I can't live that long.
I don't know about that, but you reassemble this father who you kind of feared and also admired. He's a very complex person. But so can you talk about, but your father taught you a really important message, a lesson at the end. Can you talk about that lesson?
Yeah. I knew my father for 59 years. And like other sons sitting in this audience, I have spent large swaths of my life trying to reassemble the life of a man who awed me, of whom I was in awe, and of whom I was scared for almost the entire time I knew him. A man wrote to me the other night, and he said, "My God, Paul," and I know this man very, very well, and he's a writer, and he's my age, he said, "Giving birth to this book must have been something like giving birth to a 240-pound baby." He said, "You got it done after all these years." Elizabeth is referencing, my father and I came beautifully back together toward the end of his life. We had never been estranged. There were moments of estrangement, of course. But Mark and I were in the hospital room in Safety Harbor, Florida, when the doctor came in 2003, and he was an admirer of my father because he knew of my father's great military career in Iwo Jima. But my father was a 30-year airline career guy after the war. We haven't talked about that. We don't need to. But he flew for 30 years for Eastern Airlines. This doctor admired my dad. Mark and I were in the room with two other siblings, and the doctor came in, and he said, "Joe, I know you like it straight, so here's the straight." He said, "We cannot operate on the tumor in your stomach because your heart would never take it. So there's no hope." And my father was in that room. And what I recall so vividly was that he nodded and he was saying yes before the doctor had reached the end of the sentence. He totally understood. This man that I had been in awe of and scared of, and who disciplined us in hard ways, he was showing me in that moment how to die. He was showing me about honoring an obligation, living up to one's responsibilities of doing your duty. So he was about to honor an obligation now. And he was saying, "Yes, yes, I understand. Okay, yes, yes." And the reason I mentioned Mark is that afternoon, I don't know whether it was in the late morning that this happened, Mark, or early afternoon or whatever, but the doctor came in and said that. You were there. I was there. Mark and I spent the next 4 hours madly driving around the Tampa Bay area trying to find a hospice that would take him in that day because they wanted to move my father out. They needed the bed. He was expendable metal, just like a spent airplane. They needed to get him out. And we found a hospice and got him into a hospice that day. And it was a ratty place with not ratty, but ratty enough, with crazy wallpaper and the eradicable scent of urine coming up out of the woodwork. And we got him in there. So, and he lived another 8 days.
And so, Paul, what would he think of this book?
Do you have to keep asking these questions that I can't answer? What would my father think of this book? He always knew in some sense I was going to try to write it. We went to a Night Fighters convention in 1982 in Florida. He didn't want to go, but he knew in 1982. And I was scribbling notes furiously. And he was introducing me to all of his old World War II buddies, Iwo Jima buddies. And he was making jokes like, listen, this is my son. He's a writer. He works for the Washington Post. Never tell a damn writer anything because they'll use it on you. But he was secretly proud. And he was giving me stuff through the years. What would he think of it? I don't know, Elizabeth. I think he might say that I tried very, very hard. And maybe he would give me an A-. I don't know. I do feel that I tried as hard as I could to write the truth in the right proportions. The right proportions of the sorrowful with the joyful. I once heard this line. The glorious is sometimes a synthesis of the joyful and the sorrowful. So maybe there are parts of this book that have a little bit of that synthesis of the glorious, of the joyful and the sorrowful.
Oh, the brilliant Paul Hendrickson. It's a wonderful book, and thank you to the American Writers Museum for bringing this book to all of you. And please go get it signed and buy it and celebrate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.